Welcome to a History of Horror podcast, a year-long journey through films throughout the decades, examining across the globe what makes us scared. Welcome. My name's Christopher Brown. I was being a tad facetious when I called this episode Italian Copies. When I mapped out the list of things I wanted to talk about, it did kind of flash my mind and I kind of got a bit of a grin on my face. You know, let's be honest though, the Italian film industry does have a reputation for fostering knockoff merchants. But the country's had a huge impact on horror. Not least because they're able to take American genres and make them their own. So for every Star, Beast or Spaghetti Western, there's a Black Sabbath or a Zombie Flesh Eaters. But this impression, rightly or wrong, and in my opinion, it's actually quite false, certainly in the impact of genre, that they just rip off other people's films, has definitely impacted on how Italian genre cinema has been seen. That's a bit unfair, in truth. Why, though? Well, I think we have to really look at the concept of the spaghetti western before we even start. Also known as Italian westerns, they were called macaroni westerns primarily in Japan. It's a very broad subgenre of the western genre that started about the mid-60s, mainly in the wake of Sergio Leone's filmmaking style and success internationally. Apparently, the title, despite feeling quite derogatory, was actually coined by an Italian journalist, Alfonso Sacher. The movies, it's fair to say, were originally designed to be released in Italy, but because they feature multilingual casts and sound was post-synced, mainly as an attempt to be able to be sold internationally with, you know, an international name. The idea that Italian is the dominant language in the film isn't actually true. Take, for example, Sergio Leone's Fistful of Dollars sequence of films. You know, obviously, that's got Clint Eastwood in the main character role, despite some other people, obviously, when you look at the dubbing job, speaking Italian to him while he speaks English. And of that, gave Clint his emerging star performance. Over 600 European westerns were made between 1960 and 1980. Now, Leone is obviously like the most dominant of that. Probably the reality is the good, the bad, the ugly is the one that's heralded and is seen not just as a great spaghetti western, but a great one of the greatest films of all time. And it's that Dollars trilogy that established it as the genre as a novel and unique medium. Another thing that's impacted initially and then impacted back on itself is Sergio Corbucci's Django, which obviously initially started as a very stylized, interesting film about a man who drags a coffin of guns around with him and then morphed into recently Quentin Tarantino's Deep South revenge flick Django Unchained. They use elements of the Western genre, as in, and I say the Western as in the US, American Western, and break and change them, mainly because of cultural issues, but also a deliberate skewering of that genre. And it's such a wide and broad genre. It's and covers so many films. It is deeply loved by many. I think it's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
Italy was also influenced by Gothic horror as well. In 1956, I, Vampiri was released, which is Riccardo Frida's collaboration with Mario Bava, who was at that time just a cinematographer. It was the first Italian horror film of the sound era, to give you some idea about what it, you know, what we're actually talking about with Italian horror. Frida stormed off the set after just 10 days of film and allegedly leaving Bava to complete the picture in post, simplifying the plot and cobble it together with stock footage. The film is a real-life telling of Elizabeth Balfouri's legend, a real-life vampire, and it casts a former Miss Italy runner-up as the Grand Dame residing in a big old castle. She may or may not know quite a little bit of information about local murders that are happening, whose victims have been drained of their blood. Frida mixes modern day settings with a kind of romanticised period piece style. And the castle itself is opulent, grand, but also decaying. And they use intelligent use of light and shadow as well. I, Vampiri is the first step Italy takes, not just in horror, but a very particular type of horror as well. Shape, movement, imagery, nightmare is the predominant thrust of what they wanted to achieve with this. Logic, realism, isn't as much to be seen. And that kind of idea, edited together by Bava, leads us to a different element, something that kind of sits over a huge amount of Italian horror. Not just the Gothic, but this kind of dreamlike quality that leaks in. But originally when it came up, they certainly weren't like that. Giallo is very much grounded in the 20th century. It sits in Italy between literature and film. And I'm pretty sure if you're a listener to horror podcasts, you'll have somebody have kind of given you the Giallo spiel of what it is. Let's do it one more time, just for the sake of completion on our journey. It really means, in Italy, it means, you know, old school thrillers, police procedurals, you know, everything from that to serial killer flicks, that kind of thing. For the Italians, Hannibal would be a giallo. But for our eyes, it talks about, we're talking about a very specific part of Italian horror cinema. Murder mystery films, basically, which include elements of horror fiction, sometimes some eroticism, and quite extreme violence. Began to the mid to late 1960s, was massive in the 70s, and then went off a cliff in the 80s. Occasionally, films are still made to this day that hint at giallo, or indeed are very much like giallo, such as Argento's revival film Giallo, which is poor, but you know, at least he tries, and The Strange Colour of Your Body's Tears, which is the more extreme, nightmarish qualities, and also isn't Italian. So the giallo itself is a yellow, cheap, flimsy paperback book, the kind of thing you pick up at a train station or an airport to just get you through that flight. Pulp, basically. Very popular in post-fascist Italy. And they always had these yellow covers to kind of denote the kind of content they had in them. So, in 1943, the postman always rings twice. That old was adapted by Luchino Visconti as Obsessione. It was, in truth, not in the style of what we would call a giallo. However, the book was sold as one, and as such, the film was sold as one as well. It was hailed as a landmark film in neorealism, but not giallo, unfortunately. And these kind of adaptations never really kicked off at that point. It was 20 years before they really did. So, we spoke when we talked about Germany, about crimi films. So these are crime dramas that are very popular in Germany. Pulp B-movies, basically, about, you know, criminals getting their comeuppance and the police doing the right thing. In the early 1960s, giallo was like that in Italy. You know, black and white crime movies based on Edgar Wallace stories, basically. Whodunits. If we were in England, we'd probably be talking about Miss Marple, if I'm being honest, but they're a little bit edgier over in Italy. And although they were linked with Edgar Wallace, they didn't have the gore. It was still too early in the game for that. But let's go back to Bava, a man who's now shifted over to horror films and direction at that. Yeah. Bava had already made Black Sunday by this point, which is has more in common with I, Vampiri, if I'm being honest. It's a story about, which is, you know, very stylized violence. You know, but in 1963, he invented the first true giallo, The Girl Who Knew Too Much. It nods itself to Alfred Hitchcock and The Man Who Knew Too Much. It shows the link between giallo and the crime stories that they may be influenced by. It was shot in black and white and didn't have this violence and sex that would define the later genre. But it does create what is the structure of the genre. A young American tourist in Rome sees a murder, finds a testimony dismissed by the authorities, and must uncover the killer and solve the case itself. It's a nod to German crimi films, and also a nod to what we would call Hitchcockian thrillers. He moved up a gear after that to Blood and Black Lace in 64, and that introduced a number of elements that became symbols of what we would call, what we as Western English audiences would call giallo. So, shiny weapons, black gloves, frankly, murder of fashion models, beautiful women getting killed.
A house of high fashion, a dazzling whirl of elegance, of exotic, extravagant beauties. An adventurous journey into the devastating allure of the most sophisticated women and their intimate secrets.
Suddenly, these lace curtains ignite a drama that will lacerate your emotions. Blood and black lace. Who is this shrouded, sadistic, sordid fiend who maims and murders? Why this bloodthirsty orgy, this holocaust of lives? Blood and black lace in bleeding color. For shattering, shivering, shocking experience.
The film itself wasn't a success at the time because it was quite deemed to be quite extreme, but now is considered to be, you know, iconic in the genre and certainly was influential, despite not possibly not being the key element, you know, the key thing, you know, about it. Those tropes were taken and ran by almost everyone in the genre. There are other elements as well. Margaretti's Naked You Die, Lenzi's Orgasmo, Fulci, one on top of the other. And all of them would have a creative force in the growth of the genre. All those directors were guns for hire at this stage. They weren't the established directors we believe them to be. But it's Dario Argento in 1970 that turns Giallo into what we would now see it to be. The Bird with the Crystal Plumage was heavily influenced by Blood and Black Lace. It cranked the stylish violence. It inputted as much suspense as it could, which was vital to maintaining the genre's excitement. And as such, because of the it's a great film and it works really well for an audience, it became a box office success, and as such was kickstarted the genre and became imitated. So we get this flurry of Italian films which are stylish and incredibly violent and actually quite sexually provocative as well. Argento alone started cranking them out, cemented his genre in the public consciousness. Michele Soavi, who we'll talk about briefly later, said, "There's no doubt that it was Mario Bava who started the spaghetti thrillers, but Argento gave them a great boost, a turning point, a new style, new clothes. Mario grown old, and Dario made it his own genre. This had repercussions on genre cinema, which, thanks to Dario, were given a new lease of life." And this growth of the Giallo is why we see those films as, you know, that word as this element of that far wider genre, if we're being honest. What we would call Giallo isn't what the Italians would call it. They see Giallo as just pulp thrillers, generally. Anyway, so Giallo came from German crime and American crime dramas, but was crucially very different in the end to what those films were like. So the Giallo cycle had a lasting effect, not just on itself and murder mysteries made outside Italy since the 1960s. It was the kernel for the slasher film and the splatter movie. In particular, two films from Mario Bava, Hatchet for the Honeymoon from 1970 and Twitch of the Death Nerve, known better as A Bay of Blood in the UK in 1971, which were incredibly influential, leading on to Friday the 13th, Halloween, Twitch of the Death Nerve influenced Halloween and Friday the 13th, which then were influenced all the other slasher films that happened in the US slasher cycle up to 1984. But the effect of Giallo generally can be seen in films like Berserk from 1967, No Way to Treat a Lady, Hitchcock's Frenzy in 72, Vincent Price's Madhouse, The Eyes of Laura March in 78, and more recently Barbarian Sound Studio in 2012, which is kind of a nod to Giallo and also the slightly more crazy elements that come out of that, the more nightmarish qualities. Eli Roth talks about Giallo being an influence on him, in particularly Torso and Who Can Kill a Child, although that isn't a Giallo, but, and it's also Spanish, but, you know, we'll ignore that. So Bava was born in San Remo in 1914. He was the son of a sculptor. He worked as special effects photographer and cameraman in the Italian silent era. Mario wanted to become a painter, though. Unable to turn out paintings at a profitable rate, he went to his father's business, working as assistant on other Italian cinematographers. He helped his father with the special effects, and that was a skill that he moved forward using. In fact, he even did things like some of the cinematic spiraling shots of New York were built by Barber using, you know, cartons and cardboard boxes. In 1939, he was a cinematographer in his own right. And Barber was, in fact, instrumental in other directors finding their own voice and helping as well what were Italian screen stars such as Steve Reeves and Aldo Fabrizi to kind of really shine. He's also instrumental in kickstarting the Italian sword and sandal genre, which, let's be honest with you, is definitely a rip-off of something. He worked on 1955's Kirk Douglas epic Ulysses and Steve Reeves' classic Hercules from 57. In 58, he was working on The Day the Sky Exploded, which is Italian sci-fi film. I've already mentioned very briefly Black Sunday. This came from the Vampiri element. It's influenced by Hammer horror, Gothic horror, anyway, and made a star out of Barbara Steele. It has a lovely feel and look to it, and its first 30 minutes are iconic.
Not since Dracula stalked the earth has the world known so terrifying a day or night.
It is I who renounce you, and in the name of Satan, I place a curse upon you.
Black Sunday is like no motion picture you've ever seen. Those who believe and those who do not. But both must know the suspense, the shock of meeting the living dead and of bringing the dead to life.
Look into my eyes. Embrace me. You will die, but I can bring you pleasures mortals cannot know.
Black Sunday, the most terrifying motion picture you'll ever see. Satan, wearing strange robes and fighting with all the furies of Hades, arouses the countryside to a frenzy of black terror.
And that leads on from that black and white, led on to other films such as Black Sabbath, Kill Baby Kill, and Blood and Black Lace and The Whip on the Body, as we've spoken before. By 1978, age 63, he co-directed his last horror film, Shock, with his son, Lamberto Barba. Although, as I said before, he did some matte work on Argento's 1980 film, Inferno. He died age 65. Of natural causes. So the man that grew out of this, as well as his son, Lamberto, was Dario Argento. Born in Rome and heavily influenced by Barber's work. Argento didn't attend college. He decided to become a columnist in a newspaper instead, which sounds insane these days, that you could just go, I want to be that. He started working as a screenwriter, and most notably for Sergio Leone, and collaborated on Once Upon a Time in the West, one of Leone's better spaghetti westerns that aren't in that Dollars trilogy. Soon after that film's release, he started work on The Bird with a Crystal Plume, which was released in 1970 and became a hit and kick-started his career. So you got then The Cat of Nine Tails, Four Flies on Grey Velvet as well. Argento didn't necessarily want to just direct horror. He actually went into two Italian TV dramas and a period comedy after what's considered to be his animal trilogy. But then only returning back to Deep Red, another giallo, 1975. Considered by many to be the best ever made. It certainly was the thing that kick-started his career internationally. An influence that fed in to John Carpenter's Halloween. By the time he made Suspiria in 1977, a very stylized, violent, nightmarish supernatural thriller, he'd broken the genre he'd made famous himself. He took away the constraints that giallo needed to be grounded in realism, or at least a reality that's a real person, and instead injected huge amounts of supernatural into it. Argento planned Suspiria to be a Three Mothers trilogy, which stumbled when Inferno didn't make the money it needed. In fact, it was only until 2007 where he belatedly concluded his trilogy, poorly, if I was being honest.
Roses are red, violets are blue, but the iris is the flower that will mean the end of
Suspiria! You can run from Suspiria. You can hide from Suspiria. Suspiria! But you cannot escape Suspiria. The only thing more terrifying than the last 12 minutes of Suspiria are the first 92.
Argento had another influence on a man we've already spoken about, George A. Romero, helping bring Dawn of the Dead to the screen. He flew over George and his wife and let him work on the script, and there helped co-finance the movie on the promise that he'd be allowed a cut of the international non-English language box office. He brought in his people he worked with a lot to help with the soundtrack, Goblin, who added music to Suspiria and to other ones of his films, including Profondo Rosso, Deep Red. What Goblin did was kind of add a strangeness to the soundtrack to all his work, and heightened certain elements, such as the feeling of the bizarre. By 82, Argento, a little bit disillusioned after Inferno's failings, created Tenebrae, which was again more of a traditional giallo, before again trying to blow it out with giallo and supernatural fantasy with Phenomena, also known as Creepers, which was one of Jennifer Connelly's early roles. The film received a lukewarm release that, and although it is strange, it initially did fail. Opera launched in 1987 and kind of marks the end of, for me, Argento's kind of period of greatness. It was a mishap-filled production, but still managed to kind of keep it together. But since then, he's made numerous films of lesser quality. But that can't diminish the incredible period of skill and wonder that he had. Dario is one of our masters of horror, almost certainly. And like a lot of the people we've already spoken about, they had longer than most, an incredible boom of the period of time where he was brilliant and creating all this fantastic work, and then a period of time afterwards where he's not doing as well. But that doesn't, we should never diminish how good that 1970 period, right the way through to 1987 was. That's 17 years of being on top of your game, and that's incredible achievement, and one that probably surpasses almost everyone else we've talked about, including Carpenter. So we've got a guy who pushes yellow together with supernatural elements. There's a period of time where one man made a few films that really pushes the nightmarish supernatural elements and dreamlike quality. And they're all extremely violent and not what you would call traditional giallo. Lucio Fulci was born in Rome in 1927. He originally studied medicine at college and was employed for a time as an art critic, but he went into a film career, first as a screenwriter like Argento, and then later as a director. He started off working in comedy and then directed 18 Italian comedies initially. Almost all of them are not available in English and haven't enjoyed a wider distribution. In 1969, he stepped into directing thrillers, most notably A Lizard in a Woman's Skin and The Psychic. Both those films are notable because of how they do push boundaries in terms of psychosexual and are quite extreme in their own ways. But he also worked in spaghetti westerns, such as Massacre Time and Fall of the Apocalypse. At this point, it's easy to say that he was making films as a gun for hire. Interestingly enough, some of the special effects in Lizard involved mutilated dogs in a vivisection room that were so realistic, Fulci was actually charged with animal cruelty and had to show the puppets created by his collaborator Carlo Rambaldi to the judge and explain to him they weren't real animals. The first one that actually gave him notoriety, though, was Don't Torture a Duckling. It was a mixture of social commentary and graphic violence. Although Fulci thought himself to be a Catholic and referred to himself one, the film criticises Catholicism quite strongly. Indeed, Don't Torture a Duckling was viewed as anti-Catholic, and in one of his films he's got a priest as a homicidal child killer, while another, a priest, commits suicide by hanging himself in a cemetery and is reincarnated as a demon. 79 saw his breakthrough, Zombie 2, released. It had been made earlier than that, though, and it's fair to say that it was marketed as a sequel to Dawn of the Dead from 78. Although, the two films, and it's worth pointing this out because it is seen as being this rip-off, and it isn't. It wasn't, they included some elements of zombies arriving in Manhattan to kind of show, that kind of cash in almost. But the film itself is in the jungle, action movie with zombies, which is why it doesn't have anything like the feel of Dawn of the Dead. And as such, was its own influence on the genre. He followed Zombie 2 up, or Zombie Flesh Eaters as known in the UK, with other tales of horror and supernatural, many of them featuring zombies in truth, which were common at the time. Indeed, with The Beyond, his German backers insisted that he put more zombies in there to kind of, when what he really wanted to do was do a haunted house film, which he eventually managed to do with House by the Cemetery.
Stephen, where are you? Please answer me. Steve!
In this house, what you don't know will hurt you. It was to be a getaway dream. It's becoming The runaway nightmare.
Do you see anything?
Some old steps going down.
He has been awaiting the arrival of his new guests. One by one, they are disappearing. One by bloody one.
No! No! No!
When you move to this house, before you get locked in,
there's someone in here,
read the fine print.
Mommy, hurry!
You may have just mortgaged your life. Due to the graphic nature of this film, no one under 18 will be admitted. House by the cemetery.
This is his period, though. It's a short period of time. He works with Dardano Scaretti, and he made 1980's City to Live and Dead, The Beyond, The House by the Cemetery, which is his Gates of Hell trilogy. Then The Black Cat, The New York Ripper, and Manhattan Baby. All those films were made in a two-year period, and all of them were his biggest hits, and all of them were certainly some of the most extreme violence, some misogyny in places. And certainly some of the darkest films that we'll talk about. New York Ripper features, blades on naked women. The Beyond features extreme gore and violence. But all the films are beautifully shot, dreamlike, strange, unusual. It's very keen on throwing your curveballs as a viewer, and as such, brilliant. And as because of their extremeness, they were frequently censored. Zombie Flesh Eaters, The Beyond, The House by the Cemetery are all video nasties. The New York Ripper is notorious as it was submitted to the BBFC and then suggested that even owning a copy could be considered a breach of the Obscene Publications Act. And it was it had to be removed from the country. That's kind of it's a part myth, part truth. A fantastic story about the New York Ripper is in Jake West's Video Nasties documentary Draconian Days, where it kind of talks about people in the screening room who watched it and being so shocked and like kind of shaking and crying because of the violence and the explicitness of it, and being so offended and affronted by the film. In America, the films played in drive-ins and grindhouses, the flea pits, to unrated versions to teenagers, basically, to do the job of shocking people, as these things do. In 1983, she went to make Conquest, like a sword and sandal fantasy that in Mexico. He didn't work with Soretti, and as such, the working relationship broke down anyway, and Fulci became ill with hepatitis, and in the end, he from there, his career kind of ebbed away. Fulci's films were ignored and dismissed, certainly in America. He was seen as being far more of just an exploitation character. A lot of that's down to Who Can Torture a Duckling and New York Ripper. Genre fans were very different, though, and particularly the Gates of Hell trilogy are seen as high watermarks for extreme horror. In fact, Quentin Tarantino in the US re-released The Beyond in cinemas in 1998. And he, a man who sucks up influences all over the place, speaks of Fulci being a major source of inspiration for him. And from there, it's kind of kick-started a number of reappraisals of his work, and some very nice box sets as well, for that matter, and very nice Blu-ray releases, which are greatly appreciated. But so we've talked about these great directors, but we must also point out that there's some rubbish. Bruno Mattei, who frequently went out with the name Vincent Dawn, just so he could get Dawn in the title of on the poster as a nod to Dawn of the Dead, kind of came in to kind of fix what we would call Zombie Flesh Eaters 2, what a lot of people call Zombie 3. A film that Fulci himself just could not finish. Mattei was a hack and made some real tosh, including Zombie Creeping Flesh, which although is on the nasties list because of its cover, but not because it's any good. Luigi Cozzi is loved as a kind of an interesting character. He made Hercules in 1983, Star Crash in 78, and Contamination in 1980. Contamination, another nasty, not seen as being particularly nasty anymore, but it does feature murderous alien eggs and an animatronic monster at the end, and is an enjoyable tosh, but tosh nonetheless. And then you've got people who made very variable films. Ruggero Deodato is notable for some very controversial movies, and is famous and true for one, Cannibal Holocaust. A film that, for many, is considered one of the most extreme in the history of cinema. It's been seized, banned, censored. It also, hilariously, was a precursor to films like The Blair Witch Project and Paranormal Activity, kickstarting the found footage genre, which we're now inundated by. But Cannibal Holocaust didn't start that, because there wasn't any kind of rush of genre films afterwards. But it gave the film a realism that is very notable.
Watch it, Alan, I'm shooting.
Oh, good Lord.
It's
unbelievable. It's horrible. I can't understand the reason for such cruelty. It must have something to do with some obscure sexual rite, or with the almost profound respect these primitives have for virginity.
He grew up in the shadow of a in a neighborhood which had a where the major room film studios were, and that kind of sparks his interest in it. In the 1960s, he directed some comedy, musical, thrillers before leaving cinema to do TV commercials. In 1976, he made the Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man, which when I mentioned and talk about in the video Nasties, people came to me and said, can you get hold of this? You can soon. It's coming out on Blu-ray from 88 Films. I'll get excited about that. He also made The Last Cannibal World, also known as Jungle Holocaust, with Mimi Leyen. And that kind of kickstarts the cannibal genre, which he himself kind of vivisected. And the Mondo genre with Cannibal Holocaust. I'm not going to go into length about Cannibal Holocaust. There is an hour-long episode on the Video Nasties podcast where I basically say everything there is that I have to say about that film. A fantastic mockumentary, certainly notable, but also notable mainly because it doesn't sit within a lot of Italian genre. It kind of sits outside it. It talks about Mondo movies, which is not a... And we'll touch on when we talk about Grindhouse. But it doesn't sit in a country kind of specific genre. There's a UK Mondo, American Mondo. There's kind of like trash documentaries, and Cannibal Holocaust attacks that concept of exploitation as documentary. He also made The House on the Edge of the Park, which is a nod towards The Last House on the Left. Another very troubling film, put a lot of rape in it, and unpleasant, frankly. And then from there, he kind of drifts away. He made Body Count, Phantom of Death, Dial Help. Ends up making TV movies and dramas. Some were good, some weren't. So, you know, his career is pivotal around a very short period of time. By the time we get to the 1980s, things have changed in terms of how the genre is. Diodato kind of like, you know, Cannibal Holocaust 1980. And although he filmed it in 1980, House on the Edge of the Park is a little later, and that came out in 83. Demons saw kind of... Demons is loved, but I wouldn't say it's brilliant. Produced by Dario Argento. It's Bava the Younger is... pretty schlocky, kind of overly violent, very 80s horror film about demonic possession in a locked cinema. And it's a splatter movie in the 80s sense. It's kind of action orientated, and it's very much loved. There's a great Arrow release of it. And I think a lot of people's love for it comes from when they may have seen it in their life. It's kind of that part of that crazy VHS period where you can, you know, you got a film and it was like so over the top. You're like, flipping heck, you know. So I think a lot of people as teenagers who are in their 30s and 40s now were influenced by this film because, it's one of those movies that kind of was sold as ridiculous splatter and delivered that. It's incredibly brash and as such kind of... showed that there was more to Italian horror than kind of grimness or greyness. It's also incredibly violent as well. So Lamberto Bava had actually showed some kind of interest with Macabro, which is a solid release and a good film. And he'd worked with his father on Rabid Dogs and Shock. But from there, he made Trash and... made for TV horrors and kind of hit a bit of a low. But Demons itself is, despite being, you know, sitting in a very strange subgenre of Italian horror films that kind of go for cheap 80s fun. And it's got this big, big old, you know, 80s soundtrack and stuff. It is entertaining, if nothing else. Mikhail Savary, in 1987, made Stage Fright, which is another one of these Italian films, which is actually quite good, certainly for the later period. It's giallo, but also influenced by slasher, so it's kind of, it's influenced by its own influences, films that have influenced its own genre. I wouldn't say it's traditional giallo. It's definitely a slasher movie because it's about people locked in a room and there's a monster in there, you know, a guy with a knife. But it has those kind of Italian stylings to it. Far less a murder mystery. Joe D'Amato, who obviously made Anthropophagus the Beast and some of the Black Emmanuel films, actually serves as the film's producer. So Avi kind of sits as one of the last guys that kind of keeps the ship afloat. Della Morte in 1994 kind of marks the end of what we would see being good, classic, traditional Italian horror.
watchman of the Bufalura Cemetery.
My name's Francesco Della Morte.
I don't know how the epidemic started. All I know is that some people, on the seventh night after their death, come back to life.
Is it true what they say? That the dead come back to life here at night?
With your consent, I'd like to marry Nagi.
Not as long, dear, as I've got a breath in my body.
We'll fix that right away.
Stop killing the dead. If you don't want the dead coming back to life, why don't you just kill the living? Are you listening to me?
Don't you believe me?
No.
Tough.
I did read a piece on from the BFI that kind of says that this film is like the end of Italian's golden age. It certainly shows Soavi kind of stepping away from being so influenced by Dario Argento. It has its own style. It's kind of comical, very dark. It's set in a cemetery in a remote part and pits a loner against an army of zombies. It actually kind of is a parody as much of it as it is a horror. But it's a fun, and it kind of has a go at lots of living dead flicks effectively, although it isn't itself a standard zombie movie. And then it kind of talks about love and death, and it's got a lot going on with it, let's put it that way. Right, so that's so if we say that film marks the end of that period, what's happening now? Well, we cannot say there is been a renaissance, because there hasn't, but there's been emulation with skill. Ivan Zucon started making films in Super 8 and on video, and is heavily influenced by H.P. Lovecraft. And as such, it's kind of that kind of tone has influenced him, that kind of strange, nightmarish tone. So with films like The Elsewhere, The House Escapes, and Colour from the Dark. It's that Colour from the Dark itself is influenced by H.P. Lovecraft to quite a large degree, actually. So it's set in the 1940s during the war. The child, the girl, one of them gets possessed by a demon, and there is then plenty of gore. Federico Zamboloni was born in 1968, is known for Shadow, Dreamhouse Nightmare. Shadow is a story about people who get lost in the woods, who don't agree with each other, and then end up meeting somebody who is far worse than them, and torture happens. Domitian Cristofaro is quite a... In 7 years, he's made 10 films in 7 years. He's incredibly prolific, and his movies have been distributed worldwide. Again, these are low-budget efforts, though. We're looking at things like Phantasmagoria, The Transparent Woman, House of Flesh Mannequins. I mean, you know, these are, frankly, you know, low-budget, unusual, interesting films. Again, led and attracted by nightmare qualities. But still, you know, although there are interesting Italian horror filmmakers, I think it's fair to say that no one is really kind of emulating the incredible work that came out of Italy between 1970 and 87. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, that was a glorious period of Italian cinema.
Dear Mom, looking forward to getting back on my bike. A buddy here told me about this wonderful place to ride in Europe. Hope to see you soon.
In the wake of war, he searched for peace of mind.
It's beautiful here.
In the mountains, he stepped into another fight.
Let's go hunting.
Wait.
Don't touch me!
Just leave the girl alone.
See you soon, son of a bitch.
Now.
Got you!
In the blink of an eye. Hunt is over. And the experiment is about to begin. Shadow.
Angela.
Okay, well, thanks very much for listening. I've had an email. How exciting. There's a guy called John. He says, "Hi, Chris. Finally catching up with some podcast listening, enjoying your transcontinental tour of terror. It must be nice to be talking about all these classics of the genre after the horrors of some of those video nasties. I particularly enjoyed your episodes on British horror. Whilst the Hammer's horror gets a lot of the love, I appreciate the attention given to folk horror, especially Blood and Satan's Claw. I first caught up with this late night TV years ago, and its creepy imagery and unsettling score made a real impression on me. Can't wait for you to cover the madness of 70s Euro horror, and hope you'll be giving a nod to the BBC M.M.R. James adaptations when you get to British ghost stories. Keep up the great work, all the best." Yes, John, I will be talking about M.R. James, the Ghost Stories at Christmas, which is, definitely, and I'll be talking to them at Christmas. And if you're in the Northwest, I might be trying to show some over Christmas as well. But we'll see. Thanks very much. Obviously, I think you do need to give a nod to the fact that Hammer, it was so dominant. And I think, I think a lot of modern audiences really love the folk horror stuff, but, you know, there isn't much of it, if we're being honest, so it's kind of tricky. I am enjoying what I'm doing this time around. It's a bit different, and it can be challenging sometimes to kind of pull everything together. I mean, you know, how do you condense Italian horror into an hour that kind of makes sense for people and isn't just listing loads of stuff? So hopefully I've kind of created a thread which kind of shows how everything feeds in with each other, because that's really what I want to kind of get to. I mean, obviously when you go to some parts of the world, you won't be able to do that because they aren't influenced. But at the very least, you'll be able to talk about the influence they've had on other parts of the genre. And, I think it's true to a point that everything kind of feeds back in itself in a way and kind of is, you know. So for example, like for our chat today about Italian copies, I kind of tongue-in-cheek call them Italian copies, but the reality is, you know, horror does take elements and add its own elements and then kind of grow into something else. Like a lot of culture, let's be honest. And with this, we can kind of really note that with our horror films. And, you know, obviously giallo is its own beast. In the same way, spaghetti westerns are their own beast, but they're grown out of different elements. And as such, then fed back in to the elements and settings and ideas that they originally came from. Thanks very much for all the emails and support and reviews and tweets and retweets and all that kind of thing. It's been really great. If you want to get hold of me, it would be lovely to get help to speak to you, and that'd be great. You can email me at historyofhorrorpodcast@gmail.com. You can go to the website, historyofhorrorpodcast.com, or you can get me on Twitter on @orange_monkey. So, next time, we are staying in the world of European horror. I've called this episode Cinema Bis, and that reflects the fact that we are talking about France and French horror and the B movie scene of cinema. But We won't stop when Cinema Beast disappears because there's been some fantastic recent horror that came out of France. So, until then, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.